The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's Deputy Features Editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's Features Editor. On this week's podcast, we ask, does Labour need to learn to love Brexit? Why do bite-sized histories have big appeal? And should we pity bridesmaids?
Michael Gove, our editor, writes the cover piece this week looking at Keir Starmer's Brexit deal. And he starts with quite a striking image in which he says Keir Starmer, John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn's advisor, Seamus Milne, were all sat round a table being upbraided for failing to support Brexit for left-wing reasons. And Michael goes on to reveal that over sandwiches and ginger beer, it's in fact him that is criticising them for failing to take advantage of Brexit. We spoke to Dr. Richard Johnson, who wrote the sidebar to Michael's excellent piece, as well as Dan Hannan, the Tory peer and prominent Brexit campaigner. And I started by asking Richard what he meant by saying Labour needs to learn to love Brexit.
Well, I think even the most fervent Brexiteers would admit that since we left in 2020, the public has not fallen in love with Brexit. Even people who voted Leave are not happy. Only one in four Leave voters think that Brexit has been more of a success than a failure. And a lot of Labour politicians look at those numbers and think, aha, they finally realised the error of their ways. They realised they were so cruelly tricked by what was on the side of that bus, and they realised we never should have left. And that, I think, is the animating spirit of the deal that Keir Starmer has done with the EU this week. But my argument is that actually the public are dissatisfied with Brexit because the tools that were returned to the UK as a result of leaving the EU have not been properly exploited, had not been properly used. And these are particularly tools that I think are most likely to be used by a left to centre government. Tools relating to industrial policy, whether that's state aid or nationalisation, or selective procurement, immigration. And instead, we've had a Brexit which has been overly preoccupied on free trade agreements, which I just don't think is really what is going to deliver for the communities, particularly the historically Labour communities that came out of voted Leave in 2016.
Dan, what do you make of that argument? Because you're someone that is, I think, inherently a little bit sceptical of the state, or certainly more sceptical than your average Labour politician.
Well, Brexit on its own doesn't add or subtract a penny from our national wealth. It simply removes constraints and allows us to make different choices. And how we make those choices will determine how we succeed. I think Richard is absolutely right to say that there has been disappointment at our failure to exploit opportunities. We, having left, we sat on the doorstep, if you like. We didn't really take advantage or exploit the possibilities that had opened up in front of us. But I disagree, I think, with Richard's idea of which tools we should be using. Yes, it is true that a certain kind of left-wing ideology wants to pick winners and subsidize things and have industrial strategies. But traditionally, before that, the left for a long time recognized protectionism for what it was, which was a racket that took from the poor to give to the rich, that took from ordinary people to give to cosseted and privileged special interest groups or people who were connected with the government. And that was the animating spirit of the Anti-Corn Law League, of the Chartists, all the way through to Philip Snowden and his free breakfast table promises in the 20s. Labour was a free trade party because they saw that free trade would mean lower prices, especially for the commodities that people on lower incomes spent a higher proportion of those incomes on, such as foodstuffs. And I don't think that argument is less true. I have been very disappointed by how slow we've been to take advantage of some of the trade opportunities that would actually lower prices and give people more disposable income, which would help everybody, but would particularly help people who are on lower incomes.
Well, Dan, then I would love to get your opinion about a point that our editor Michael makes in his piece, in his cover piece for this week's Spectator, because, of course, you are both very prominent figures in the Vote Leave campaign. And he says that he believes that we, meaning a series of Tory governments, have defined Brexit success in a way which the people who voted for it did not recognise, by which he means the number of free trade deals secured. So his vision of Brexit seems to be very much not one that's preoccupied with free trade. I assume that's a diagnosis you disagree with.
Obviously, your editor, who I consider a friend and who I look up to in many ways, has been on something of a journey on economic policy. And this journey, I think, began when he was, or was certainly underway when he was at agriculture. It is always popular to prop up old industries. Human beings are nostalgic. We regard the jobs that we remember from childhood or that we saw in picture books when we were small children as more real than jobs that we don't really understand in services. And we therefore assume that they're more valuable, and we assume that somehow it's for governments to make that call on our behalf. But whenever governments do try and make that call, they end up making things worse. They end up picking not winners, but politically connected and effective lobbyists. And the idea that the route to prosperity is to have a big agricultural sector, as Michael suggests, or to revive some of the older manufacturing industries. I mean, it's always popular to say that because it's intuitive, but it's wrong. The countries that have tried to do that always end up becoming needlessly poorer. There's nothing to say that this or that job is worth more except what other people are prepared to pay for it. That's what determines, if you like, the optimum allocation of your investment. And when politicians come in and try and put their thumbs on that scale, almost always we end up making these decisions because of political rather than economic criteria. And hence the story that all of your listeners over a certain age will remember, which is when we had nationalized industries or industrial strategies, far from picking winners, it was the losers picking the government.
Do you think, would you disagree with Michael then when he says that during the referendum, the Vote Leave campaign deliberately avoided arguments about trade and instead focused on funding for the NHS and so on? I mean, is your argument one that is inherently not popular?
Well, I don't think we can be said to have avoided it. I remember a lot of pamphlets where we said, we want free trade with the US, we want free trade with India and the Commonwealth and so on. And it was, and Michael in those days was much more of a free trader than the author of this column. So I don't think that was something we hid. But look, I mean, 17 million people voted Leave, more than 17 million. Inescapably, in that coalition, we had Trotskyists and far-right people and everyone in between. And the one thing we all came together on was that we wanted to make our own decisions. I think that was the unifying message, that these things should be decided through our own democratic mechanisms and procedures. Now, of course, we're now free to disagree with one another as to what solutions we apply. And, you know, I'm very happy to have that argument now with Richard and with Michael and with others. But I'm very glad to live in a country where we can determine those things democratically instead of having them handed down to us. And I'd rather sometimes be on the losing end of the argument than live in a place where I don't get any say.
Richard, what do you make of the argument that the great opportunity of Brexit is actually free trade?
Well, first of all, I don't fully accept Dan's historical rendering of the Labour Party's view on trade. I think that the formula that the left historically supported was open trade on food, protection on manufacturers. And so if you go back and look at the 1970s, when you had people like Barbara Castle and Tony Benn and Michael Foot and Peter Shaw making the arguments for leaving the common market as it was then, they talked about having a cheaper shopping basket when it came to food, but they also talked about the dangers of the flood of imports of manufactured goods coming from Western Europe into Britain and the risk of factories closing in Britain and relocating to Italy or somewhere else where labor was cheaper. So it's a nuanced argument in that respect. And I think that when it comes to the other point that Dan made about the winners and losers and going back to the 1970s, look, I think a lot of people today, they don't look at the 1970s and say that was a disaster. They look at the 2000s and say globalization has been a disaster. They look at their communities around them and they think, if this was the great alternative, bring me back to the days when the government was picking winners and losers, because people in my communities had stable employment. They were doing jobs that meant something to them, their families, that they could provide a living wage. They could have holidays. They could, you know, all of these kinds of things, which now they look around them and they just see blight. They see low-skilled jobs where there isn't opportunities for career progression. And the only opportunity they see in their communities is for people to leave.
I think that's based on a bizarre misremembering of the 1970s, Richard. 10% of people in the mid-70s didn't have indoor toilets. Half of people didn't have a colour TV. The quality of life that people now take for granted was unimaginable to most people in the 70s. And what has taken us from this age of the three-day week, the prices and incomes policies, the constant power cuts, the days lost through labour, the rubbish and all the rest of it. What has taken us from that to this age of wiki and Wi-Fi and Netflix is falling prices. It means that we have to work a shorter number of hours to live at a higher level, and we use the time that we save to invent and make and sell other things, and that's what has driven economic growth.
But even if everything you say there is true, isn't there also a degree to which there are communities that have been very left behind by globalization? And a lot of the people who live in those communities will feel that Brexit was an opportunity to correct some of that that has not been realized.
Well, when I was in the European Parliament, I should put on the table that I represented a southern and prosperous region, right? So I didn't have a lot of the heavy manufacturing and the communities you're talking about. But there was one exception, which was the old dockyard at Chatham. And that closed in 1984, around about the same time that the steel mills and the coal mines were closing in the rest of the country. And I used to hear anger about it, even, you know, 30, 40 years later. And understandably, if you've got a secure job as a welder, say, and you lose it in your 40s through no fault of your own, the whole structure of your life collapses, you are bound to be furious about it. And I used to get this a lot from people in China, you know, that evil witch, Margaret Thatcher, she hated working people. Understandable. But it's only fair to tell that story right through to the end. Unemployment in the constituency that contained that shipyard going into the pandemic was less than 2%. There are more people working there now than when it was a shipyard. And what are they doing? Medway University is there, and there's a certain amount of kind of industrial heritage tourism. But the biggest employer is the audiovisual sector. It's where we make Sherlock. It's where we make Call the Midwife. The grandsons of those guys are tapping at screens for a living. And I think that people need to look at the full perspective. My maternal grandfather was a shipyard worker in the west of Scotland on the Clyde. And he had the typical unhealthy west of Scotland lifestyle. He smoked very heavily. He died when he was, I think, 60, 61. So I never met him. So I never had the chance to ask him whether he would have wanted to keep that style of industry going at any cost to the taxpayer, to the consumer, whatever. But I have a pretty shrewd idea. If he could see what my cousins are doing for a living, he would not regard that as a step backwards. And it is really important that we don't get caught up in the nostalgia here and we look at the overall picture of how people are living as the new investment comes in.
Richard, why is it, do you think, that your view of Brexit, what's sometimes called Lexit, you know, a statist, interventionist Brexit, why do you think it hasn't caught on in today's Labour Party?
Two reasons. I think the first is that the Labour Party long ago lost a sense of faith in the power of the state. Back when the Treaty of Rome was first introduced, Nye Bevan, who was himself an early skeptic of the European project, said that this project of free trade is a result of a failure of socialists to make use of the powers of their sovereign parliament to plan their economic life. And it is a step back to, as he called it, the jungle of the 19th century and liberalism. And basically, that faith that Bevan had in the power of parliament to do transformative things, whether that was to nationalize the hospitals in this country, whether that was to nationalize the mines, to take into both into ownership and to plan the economic life of the country in a way that was much more equitable, evaporated by the end of the 20th century. The second element of it is that there is a cultural cringe around being in favor of Brexit in the Labour Party, where if you are seen to say anything nice about Brexit, you are viewed as dodgy, maybe racist.
Because of the company you keep? Is that
because of the company you keep? It's a guilt by association, and it's a very, very simplistic, vibe-based thinking in the party. But unfortunately, that is pretty pervasive. And I have to say that over the years, I supported Brexit in 2016, and I was a PhD student at the time, but I did talk about it in public forums, and I did have people in Labour come up to me and say, I will be voting Leave on 23rd of June, but I can't tell anyone, and please don't tell anyone. And there was a bit of that. There was a bit of that. But I think even now, the problem also is that so few people are left in the Labour Party who make these arguments, because they've been made to feel so unwelcome that they've joined another party, or they've just stopped being active in politics.
And Dan, just finally, why do you think your kind of liberalising vision of Brexit, what's sometimes caricatured as Singapore on Thames, also didn't capture the imagination of Conservatives while they were in office?
Well, these things are always unpopular when polled in opposition. I've never understood why Singapore is used as a swear word. I think I'd much rather be poor in Singapore than poor in the UK. I'd much rather have their public health system. I'd much rather have their public transport. I'd much rather have their education system. I'd much rather have their longevity rates, right? There is no question that you are... I'm not going to claim that Brexit could bring us their unchanging equatorial haze in place of our glorious changing seasons. But it is bizarre to me that Singapore, to people on the left, let alone to free marketeers, has become this scare word. Because the government of Singapore, which still I think technically considers itself socialist, would say we have created a society that is both efficient and prosperous and egalitarian. And so the framing, I suppose, of the market as a way of helping the rich at the expense of the little guy, I think that is completely an inversion of the reality. What big corporates love more than anything else is to intervene in a way that disadvantages their rivals and helps them. And therefore, and this is why I say the big, if you look at the great free traders down the ages, from Adam Smith and Ricardo onwards, they were generally what we would now consider progressives, right? They were in favor of a wider franchise. They were abolitionists. They were in favor of curtailing the power of the monarchy in the House of Lords. And they all understood that they were acting on behalf of the little guy. And that's something that at some point in the 20th century weirdly got lost, but it didn't cease to be true. So look, I'm aware that this is a difficult argument because it's counterintuitive, right? We're a tribal species. We evolved on the savannas of Pleistocene Africa. We have maladaptations. We want to have a stash of food to see us through the winter and so on. So free trade is always counterintuitive. There's never been an age in which it is popular, but it always works. And when it really, when it beds down, is when people have seen it working in somewhere like Singapore, where you really don't have a protectionist faction because people can see that it has delivered extremely well.
Well, speaking of being counterintuitive, Dan, do you think it's fair to say that when it comes to these arguments about the different types of Brexit, you're a rare beast in that you're, to use the kind of language of David Goodhart, you're a Brexit anywhere?
Those are tendentious labels, right? I mean, I consider myself quite somewhere-y in my life. I'm never happier than when tramping around the byways and footpaths where I live. I can bore you about cricket scores, and I've never been to Davos, right? It's a sleight of hand to pretend that if you believe that you make people richer by removing obstacles, by allowing you to sell me something and me to buy it without the state coming between us and preventing our contract, that somehow means that you're in favor of mass immigration and rule by the WEF and all the rest of it. And I, I, that 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 framing has led to this really unpleasant polarization in the US, and it's something we could do without here.
Well, Dan and Richard, thank you both very much indeed for joining us.
Will, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I think I'm going to draw attention, if I may, to Christopher Howell's notes on typos. It's a very witty, beautifully written piece in which he talks about the joy one can get from misprints. Particularly, I liked an example he gives of a sub-editor who asterisks out the wrong half of the word motherfucker. So it's just bleep fucker. So I really do recommend that to all listeners. How about you, Gus? What did you enjoy?
I enjoyed the piece by our colleague and friend Angus Colwell on the term the lanyard class. This has recently entered the political lexicon from the Labour peer Morris Glassman and has been picked up by The Times. But Angus wanted to understand a little better what Glassman means by the phrase, so he went along to the House of Lords to talk to him about it. And as you can imagine, the lanyard class is supposed to kind of capture a lot of the liberal, officious kind of mindset of a certain class of people. And I think Angus did a very good job of it. And we can hear a clip of Angus reading that article now.
Globalization, liberalism, neoliberalism, managerialism, internationalism, multiculturalism, human resources, wokeness, identity politics, progressivism, EDI, DEI, corporatism, proceduralism, elitism, environmentalism, transnationalism. There are a lot of things that voters are said to be protesting against. But now there's a new buzzword going around. What voters are really annoyed about is the lanyard class. Lord Morris Glassman came up with the phrase. I visit him in the House of Lords, wearing my parliamentary lanyard, of course, to ask him what he means. He says, the lanyard came into my head about 18 months ago as the symbol of the progressives. It was more of a poetic idea, the lanyard. I wrote a couple of poems that will never be published on the lanyard, as a symbol for something horrible that I was trying to decipher. Glassman is the founder of Blue Labour, a culturally conservative faction of the Labour movement that is appreciated by several in Number 10 and across the Atlantic. He was the only Labour figure to be invited to Donald Trump's inauguration. Glassman first mentioned lanyards in an interview with The Observer last month, and then expanded on it in an address at the Policy Exchange think tank. I was in the audience, and several people repeated the phrase, lanyard class, back to him during the questions. Earlier this month, Janice Turner wrote in The Times that the strength of reform could be attributed to a rebellion against the lanyard class. The officious, rules-obsessed professional cadre who set the tone in corporate HR and run the public sector, she wrote. If you look at archive footage from the 1980s, the lanyard barely seems to exist. Yet over the course of the following 30 years, it became ever-present. When you started a job, you were given your work laptop, your work email account, and your work lanyard. In 2019, all MPs were given a new member's guidebook that said that they were required to wear a visible photo identity pass at all times around Parliament. Lanyards have also become vessels for people to advertise their politics. There are Pride lanyards, BLM lanyards, Free Palestine lanyards. Esther McVeigh, after being appointed Rishi Sunak's Minister for Common Sense, tried to ban civil servants from wearing rainbow-coloured lanyards. The next day, Number 10 said the attempted ban was not going to be prescriptive. The lanyard's origins were as a tool for violence. The word comes from the French lanière, meaning strap. In 17th century France, straps were used by soldiers to secure quick access to their swords or pistols. Centuries later, you could argue that they're still a weapon, this time for compliance, wielded by bureaucrats. Okay, that might be a bit of a stretch, but Glassman thinks the lanyard is still a powerful cultural symbol for what voters are raging against. He says, there is an insurrection. When I went to the United States for the inauguration, I saw this rejection of the lanyard. People were throwing them in the bin. I would summarise reform and Trump as a rebellion against the lanyard class, from the people who have to wear them and have to be compliant. It's a class issue. A class war against the lanyard is how I would describe the present moment. When Keir Starmer spoke of an island of strangers during his recent crackdown on immigration, he was tapping into rage against the lanyard, Glassman says. Wittingly or unwittingly, he was engaging with the lanyard rebellion. We don't know each other. Why do we have to walk around with our own face on a badge of ourselves? Glassman's now in full flow. Communism was a lanyard system. Party members would have their laminated lanyards. It's also part of the VIP culture. I'm a VIP. I can go backstage. It's a disgusting thing. He is surely right that there is a revolt against a certain legalised procedural and managerial workplace culture. And perhaps he has found the perfect symbol to represent it. The workers have nothing to lose but their lanyards.
Next, why are so many readers turning to short histories? The historian Alice Loxton writes in the magazine this week about the popularity of books with titles such as A Short History of England, The Shortest History of Scandinavia, and The Shortest History of Music. While some may consider these books a dilution of historical study designed to satisfy generations of distracted readers, Alice seems to come to the defense of them, saying that there is something liberating about how non-committal they are. So, should we embrace the short history? Alice joined the podcast to discuss, along with the historian Professor Simon Heffer. I started by asking Alice why she thinks these titles are so popular.
Yes, it's a really interesting question. So, I think you have to think about the fact that publishers have chosen to commission this again and again and again. And publishers are mainly driven by sales. And so these books obviously sell. And the question is why? Why do people go into a bookshop and why does this kind of the shortest ever history of this enormous topic appeal? This is what I was trying to explore in the article this week. And I think, you know, lots of people I talk to about this, lots of publishers, they jump to the idea of our brains rotting through social media and the modern age and digital technology and not being able to focus. But I actually think it's something that's deeper than that. And perhaps it's, you know, we have this guilt in this age where there's so much information everywhere that we feel like we should know about these big topics and we don't. And so actually these short histories, they're shortcuts, essentially. It's the quickest way and the most manageable way in our minds that we can probably, that we think that we can take in this information. Whether or not that is the case, you know, I'm sure lots of people who buy those books maybe don't even read them. But I think in that moment when we're standing in the bookshop, looking at that table, I think that is the hook. And so that's why they do sell.
Simon, I would love your opinion on these types of books. Do you think it's fair to call them a shortcut like that? And are they a bad thing?
Well, you know, I feel a bit of a trailblazer because 18 years ago, I published a book called A Short History of Power, which was only about 45,000 words long and summed up the four reasons why wars break out. I won't spoil it for your listeners and readers. It's still available. They can buy it and find out. So I'm entirely in favor of these books. I think people like them because, as Alice has said, a lot of people don't have the time to read a big book. A lot of people are very busy. And if you talk to any publisher, they understand that commercially, a shorter book is often better. But there are some subjects that require long books. I mean, you've asked me on today because I'm a notorious long book writer.
Yeah.
The last four history books I wrote were around 950 pages each, but they covered very large sweeps of time.
Mm.
And that's what my publisher wanted. They've all sold well. There are people out there who want big history books, and there are subjects that can only be covered in depth if you're going to do it properly. If you want to do something really superficially, that's what Wikipedia is there for, really. But I do agree that there are certain subjects where you can deal with the nub of something that people want to know about in a relatively short space of pages. And I think, Alice, in your article, you mentioned an excellent series of biographies of British monarchs that are, again, about 40,000 words each. And they tell you everything you need to know about these people. So it can be done, and I wouldn't rule it out, but I think it would be dangerous for us to lose sight of the value of the comprehensive history.
Mm.
You know, without going back to the Victorian three-decker, the comprehensive history that actually tells someone in great depth about a subject.
Yes. Well, Alice, I would love your opinion about, I suppose, that side of the equation, the comprehensive history, as Simon just put it. Do you think there's a risk that, or are there historians that you know of who perhaps getting a little bit of sour grapes about these little histories, these brief histories, and so on? Because, you know, historians might have worked for years and years and years of their life to produce extremely comprehensive history of a topic, only to see the publishers paying so much attention to these potted histories, and those are the ones that often, as you say, sell very well. Is that a point of annoyance for certain historians?
I'm not sure. I have to say all historians are very friendly, I found, and everyone's very positive about all history books. But I suppose I'm a case in point to play devil's advocate in that I'm not someone who's, a great professor at Oxford University, but I have written a book which is title, which has this title 18, and then it's A History of Britain Through This Lens of Young People. So it does say on the cover, A History of Britain. And I suppose that is, and that's something that, you know, I've taken 18 different figures and done these very short 3,000 word chapters. Is that truly a history of Britain? You know, there's a lot of gaps there, and it's only looking at people below the age of 19. So it's obviously not comprehensive at all, and yet it takes that title, A History of Britain. So I suppose maybe that is annoying I think it's just this kind of sales hook that has been used, and it's kind of interesting why publishers. There's something about appearing to be comprehensive. That's the interesting thing. You know, there are books like A History. I went into Hatcher's Piccadilly the other day, and there are so many of these books. So, for example, in the article, I talk about the shortest histories, but there's also a history of a big topic within a list. So, for example, The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places, A History of Britain in 10 Enemies. So that's like obviously another kind of hook. And I guess it's just another way to package it. But I also think that they're sold as these fun books. You know, my book is not sold as the authority on British history. It's sold as a fun, digestible book that you can, you know, you could honestly just read one or two of the chapters, and it doesn't, you know, they're probably kind of interesting little snippets in their own right. And I think, you know, you can, it's a nice book to chat about after you've read it on holiday. But, you know, it's you're never going to, I suppose, because you're not being forced to go into real depth, you know, in kind of the books that Simon writes, then perhaps you don't have such a reward in your depth and understanding of knowledge.
I thought, Alice, your idea was a very clever one.
Thank you.
And that way. Well, no, it's the sort of thing that a boring old fart professor like me would never have. And there's nothing wrong with finding new dimensions through which to tell history. You know, nearly 200 years ago, Thomas Carlyle famously said, "The history of the world is but the biography of great men." He'd now say great men and women, I'm sure. But, you know, there's been a constant search for new ways to tell history. But what I don't like, and I've been into Hatchards and seen these books, some of these books are obviously just stunts or gimmicks.
Yeah.
You make no pretensions to your book, and it's the better for it. But some people are just desperately scrabbling around thinking, well, how can I make a few more bob out of history? I know, I'll do it, you know. The history of England in 100 cakes or something. I'm just not interested.
That's a good idea.
I like that one, Simon. I think if any publishers listening, someone needs, please commission 100 cakes.
Have it on me, Alice. But I really worry about the way history is taught in our schools and universities at the moment. And I wish I could encourage more people to read more serious history. I don't just mean read all the boring, bloody great books I write, but to go back to the classics, I mean, to read Gibbon, to read Macaulay, to read Froude. Froude's history of the Tudors is absolutely brilliant. It's unintentionally hysterically funny because he's so rude about people like Mary Tudor, but no one reads it. And there are these magnificent classics of Georgian and Victorian history that are waiting to be rediscovered. And I hope that we might go back at some stage and look at longer in-depth history, even stuff that's been surpassed in its scholarship, you know, over the last 100 or 200 years, because it's great literature and it's very thought-provoking.
Mm.
Alice, you, as well as having written your book 18, which you've mentioned, you run a very popular history account on social media. I wonder if you could talk to our listeners a little bit about that, because social media is obviously a relatively new way of bringing history to people. And what approach do you use when it comes to your account in terms of getting across, I suppose, as much information in as little time as possible?
Yes. So I have social media accounts across platforms like TikTok and Instagram. And I basically make 1 to 2 minute videos about historic locations in Britain. So that might be going to churches or cathedrals or castles or country houses, or even just explaining items on the streets that you can find across the country. So one of the most popular videos I've ever made has been the history of bollards and brickwork. So things that people are very familiar with often does very well. So, you know, looking at bollards or brickwork or windows, or, you know, things like the window tax You know, I say, why have you ever noticed why these windows, you know, they're bricked up, and it's all because of this history that stretches back to 1696.
So is it sort of things that people maybe take for granted in their everyday life that maybe they just want to hear a little bit more?
Yeah, and that goes viral. It's amazing. It's a kind of really interesting insight into to what the you know, what hooks people in. So things which are very, very familiar to people, and then there's this amazing history behind it, that always does incredibly well. And etymology is a bit like this, you know, have you ever heard this phrase? Well, there's a history behind it. So anyway, I just make lots of videos, I post every day, and I work with lots of organizations like the National Trust and Linked Heritage and everything. And so it's very interesting because I, you know, social media gets a terrible rep, probably rightly. I'm sure that it has, you know, shortened our attention spans and everything, and people waste their lives on it, but and myself included. But equally, it has proved to be this amazing platform to educate people about, you know, quite, you know, important bits of history, I suppose. So people really have learnt a lot through my social media accounts. And it's things like the encaustic tiles of Winchester Cathedral, or the process of gauged brickwork, which I did with the Society of Protection of Ancient Buildings. So I guess I've just tried to utilise these platforms and educate people about history. And they weren't, you know, when I was at uni 5 years ago or 6 years ago, these didn't exist in the way they do now, and maybe they won't in 5 years to come. So I think it'll be interesting to see where, you know, the next TikTok is, and maybe that's podcasting. Obviously that's had a huge boom, but I suppose it's just going back to the books thing. It's just educating people, you know, sharing these historic stories in whatever platform is works at that moment of time. So I suppose perhaps we have to be flexible.
Alice and Simon, thank you both very much indeed for joining me.
And finally, the wedding hell that awaits bridesmaids. Earlier this month, a bride in Northern Ireland decided to have 95 different bridesmaids. And I actually got talking to some of our colleagues in the pub about bridesmaids and bridesmaids' dresses. And it turns out that if you talk to women about this stuff, they tell you that it's an absolute nightmare. It's very difficult to get the right cut or the right colour. And I decided to get in contact with Sophia Money Coutts to ask her about her experiences of being a bridesmaid. And I've also invited along my good friend and arts and books section regular, Francesca Peacock, who had a wedding last year, to join our discussion about bridesmaids and bridesmaid dresses. I started by asking Sophia whether being a bridesmaid really is an honour or whether it's just a massive pain.
Oh, I think it's probably more brutal, because these days it's not just about the day itself. It involves quite a lot in the lead up to the big day as well. The hen do, for instance. I have been a bridesmaid and a maid of honour. Delighted to have been both, obviously.
Disclaimer.
The organisation that is involved, when a bride is already losing her mind, no offence to any friends of mine who are listening to this, it's pretty hellish, I have to say. Not to sound ungrateful, but I would dodge if you can avoid it.
And Cheska, you very politely invited me to your wedding. I wasn't asked to wear a dress, but how did you approach your bridesmaids?
I feel like I have to say on the record that my bridesmaids were wonderful and I love them, and thank you so much for everything you did. Looking back on it, I think I did briefly lose my mind. I read in your piece, Sophia, your wonderful line about sludge green dresses. For a period of about 2 months, I was convinced they were going to wear green, and it took them putting the dresses on, us all looking in a mirror and being like, God, to actually decide it just wasn't worth the effort.
It's so weird. No offence to you, Jessica, but what happens to brides' brains that suddenly colours, which no one in their right mind would seriously entertain normally, are deemed like the appropriate thing to put not one, but six, or as I say in my piece, 95 women in, if you've got the number of bridesmaids that the bride in County Down had the other day. It's mad.
Absolute madness. I think completely ridiculous. And then I went to the opposite end. I was like, you can wear what you want and quite relaxed. And then I think because both my bridesmaids, it was their first time being bridesmaids, and I only had two in a kind of like damage control limitation style of method of picking, they ended up wanting to wear the same thing. So there everyone knew they were bridesmaids, which I think was quite lovely, a uniform choice.
Well, actually, so on the point about only having two, Francesca, the point that Sophia makes in a piece, sort of starts the piece with this incredible story of a wedding in which there were 95 bridesmaids. When you got married, was that a difficult choice in terms of who you choose to be those very few and who you exclude, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, with 95, is surely that not like half the guests or most of the guests?
I think they had, did they have 300 or something? Yeah, it was the vast majority of guests, and they ranged from very young to...
I mean, you'd be kind of humiliated if you weren't one of the bridesmaids at that point.
Yeah.
It's sort of the inverse problem.
Being one of the few women not in champagne and cream, which was the colour theme for the bridesmaids at that particular wedding.
No, that is worse, actually, than having just one or two, is having 95, because if you don't make the cut of 95, you really are the favourite.
But Cheska, did you have to have difficult conversations?
I'm going to sound like a complete idiot in this. I should have had difficult conversations. I got engaged on Christmas Eve and I saw my oldest friend in the world on Boxing Day, and I had like one glass of wine, another glass of wine, and pretty soon she was my maid of honour without really any thought in the process at all. And I'm very glad she was, because she is my oldest friend and I've known her since we were babies. So that was really lovely. And then my other bridesmaid I'd also known since school. And so I ended up on a strict first in protocol, and all of my university friends, whom if I had asked any of them to be bridesmaids, I would have had to have had about 12, which would have been lovely. I think they were all very understanding, because they thought that I perhaps had done a bit of a weird picking system, which I had in a way, which is lovely.
Well, also, again, not to be the sort of voice of gloom, but maybe some of them might be a bit relieved not to be a bridesmaid. Again, no offence. I'm such a Grinch. But I don't think not having the responsibility is the worst thing sometimes.
Sophia, you have some amazing quotes in this piece. I mean, like some unbelievable stories. One of them is from a source who tells you that she found out that she wasn't going to be made a bridesmaid, so decided to turn up on the day wearing exactly the same shade of pink as the bridesmaids.
Yeah, and you know what, Gus? That's not actually the first time I've heard of a woman doing that. Again, brides, do you respect Cheska, sometimes lose their minds when it comes to weddings. And again, I think so do... I mean, as I've said, I would be delighted not to be a bridesmaid, but I think some people really, really, really do mind about it, particularly maybe if you haven't... You know, I'm now 40 and very jaded, obviously, and not married myself. But I think if you're younger and you're starting the wedding process with all your friends, it matters maybe more than once you've spent 5 summers going to weddings. So yeah, so this woman was so cross that she hadn't been asked that she just decided to, you know, rock up in essentially the same outfit. She's quite brave in a way. I quite admire it.
I wonder whether or not either of you had heard stories of perhaps this mindset kind of infecting men, perhaps. Maybe prescriptions around ties or waistcoats. The only reason I'm asking is I currently have my morning suit in the office and I'm about to disappear off to my sister's wedding, which I have been totally uninvolved in, which I'm quite happy with. I don't want to have anything to do with it. But I'm worried that one day someone is going to send me an invitation saying, we want you to wear this particular shade of duck egg blue on your waistcoat.
Can I just say I love the idea that I expect all Spectator employees, male employees, have their morning suits in the office. That's like that thing, this is not totally relevant, but I think it was Knight Frank or one of the posh estate agencies once had to send an email around reminding their employees not to bring their guns in during shooting season if they were going off for the weekend. Similar. I haven't personally come across that, no. Although obviously you get men in sort of matching buttonholes. I think that's about as far as it goes, isn't it? I haven't seen matching waistcoats, although Cheska, you may well have done.
I haven't. I don't think I have. But I wonder, I think we're probably getting ever closer. I feel like it's only one step. If not the groom, then the bride would ask. It makes photos nicer or something like that.
Yeah, it's only fair, I think. If women have to be matching, then...
Ritualised humiliation for all.
Equality, I say.
Well, Sophia and Francesca, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. And congratulations to your sister, Gus.
Yeah, congrats to her.
And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed our discussions, pick up a copy of the magazine to read all the articles we talked about in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Gus Carter. And we hope you join us again next week.